This is WAER's 2020 Focus on Elections. I'm Scott Willis. We're taking a deeper dive into the results from Super Tuesday and what they mean going forward. Former Vice President Joe Biden enjoyed a surge in support following his success in South Carolina. That means a shift in momentum for the other candidates, and the field continues to shrink. New Yorker Mike Bloomberg is out, throwing his support behind Biden. But a number of larger swing states are still in play over the next couple weeks. What does that all mean for when delegate-rich New York gets its turn on April 28th? We'll also talk about the challenges behind rallying the party and its voters behind a single candidate. Joining me in studio are Shayna Guderian, Associate Professor of Political Science at Syracuse University's Maxwell School, and Jonathan Parent, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Lemoyne College. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
So what are your big takeaways from Super Tuesday? Any surprises here?
So I think one of the big surprises that came this week was that the party infrastructure basically started to make some decisions and making endorsements and throwing its support behind Joe Biden. So we have a couple of like different theories of how primaries happen. One is about momentum, that candidates get some early wins and then the kind of voters start to move their way. There's another view that it's about party establishment and the party using its infrastructure and influence to try and help make endorsements for candidates, and that then this signals to voters that they should then get behind one candidate. I think we've seen like both of those things happen this week, and that to me is the surprise about how quickly it happened.
I think one of my takeaways from Super Tuesday was sort of in contrast to the Republican primary in 2016 that Donald Trump came out of, just in the sense that it seems like maybe some lessons were learned on the Democratic side there in terms of some of the candidates that really weren't going to end up being all that competitive dropping out earlier than was the case in the Republican primary in 16. And I think that was very much on purpose, and I think that was probably a wise decision if the party itself wants to have more control over who the nominee is.
How much is Super Tuesday, in this case, a bellwether as far as any emerging trends, or is it too early? I mean, where are we at in the process here to kind of determine where things are going?
Well, I think one thing to note is to get the primary nomination, you have to have a majority of delegates. And so this whole process is to gather delegates, and you can get delegates even if you don't win states. But Super Tuesday was a really big part of this process, because in order to win the nomination, you have to have a majority, which means 1,991 delegates, and there were 1,300 delegates up last night. So it's a really big part of the process. That doesn't mean the process is over. No one has a majority right now. There are still a lot of states to go. But it is a signal, it seems to me, about how the party, like Jonathan said, how the party has now basically gotten behind Biden, and thinking about what those dynamics between essentially Biden and Sanders are going to be going forward.
Yeah, I think that it's pretty clear after Super Tuesday that it's a two-person race at this point. It's really going to be between Sanders and Biden. I mean, there's sort of rumors going around. I'm not sure it's going to happen or not, but that Elizabeth Warren is likely going to make an announcement tomorrow, which I think most people anticipate will be her dropping out, which really will leave no one left other than the two front runners. So,
is there any way to know, you know, kind of piggybacking on what you've said already, both of you, how the results might have been impacted by the exit of Tom Steyer, Pete Buttigieg, and Amy Klobuchar, with the latter two endorsing Biden? What does it mean for the others, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, at this point anyway?
I mean, I think the conventional wisdom would be simply that they were trying to consolidate behind a moderate candidate, mm-hmm. in a, you know, pretty straight down the line sort of anti-Bernie sort of mobilization, really to keep Bernie from getting the nomination. I think that would be the sort of most obvious, maybe conventional interpretation. I don't know if it's necessarily that clear, only because that sort of relies on an idea of there being lanes, you know, there being sort of a moderate lane and a progressive lane and maybe even a conservative lane. And there's a lot of evidence that isn't really true. in the sense that, you know, candidates who would often have second choices that we wouldn't necessarily expect in terms of lanes, right? It's not necessarily a guarantee that, you know, a Klobuchar supporter's second choice would be Biden. It might very well be, you know, Sanders. It's not quite as clear as I think oftentimes it's made out to be, particularly in the media, of, you know, that there's, you know, this group of moderate voters that's just going to stick with moderates. People don't necessarily think, voters don't think necessarily as ideologically, I think, as we often assume they do.
I do think that there's another piece of this that matters, is that the infrastructure that each of these campaigns who's dropped out have and has in their campaign staff still can matter. So Klobuchar's campaign in Minnesota sent, they recorded ads for Biden, and they sent out campaign staff to actually knock on doors for him. So the party has infrastructure that it can use. And so it's not just about convincing voters necessarily on ideological grounds. It's also about doing the hard work of actually turning people out. And the kinds of voters who might be more likely to turn out for a Biden rather than a Sanders are older voters who are kind of easier to get in these ways that parties are really good at, which is to, again, knock on doors and remind people, give them rides to the polls. And so I do think there's that work that the campaign staff and infrastructure is doing.
Other big battleground states like Michigan, Florida, Illinois, and Ohio are up next. What's New York's role? Is it relevant as one of the last large states in the primary process?
That remains to be seen. I mean, I just there's no way we can tell that now. Mm-hmm. It's going to depend on how well Biden does, as you said, in those sort of Ohio-type states that are coming up next. If he really walks away with that, then obviously New York's importance is going to be diminished. But if they split the delegates a lot like happened in Texas and even California, then I think New York could certainly matter. Right? It is, after all, the second biggest state. Right? We're not actually the biggest or the second biggest state population-wise, but in terms of delegate count, New York actually is the second after California. We even have more delegates than Texas. So.
I also think in terms of relevance, I think the more people get attuned to what's going on in politics now, the better they will be positioned in November to know who they want to vote for, but also make some plans about where their polling places are, right? So we make voting really hard in this country.
And this state, to be honest.
Right, and this state. It's becoming a little easier in this state. But, you know, a lot of voting is actually habit forming. And so while New York voters might not have a big say in the Democratic primary, they'll figure out where their polling places are and when they're open, and they'll figure out how to register and all of those things that are really necessary for the act of voting in the general. And again, even if they don't tip the scales for one candidate versus another, on the part of voters, they're going to learn something about the process. And that is in and of itself important.
Is there an expectation for how energized New York voters will be given what they've seen on the ground, which, as far as we know, has been almost nothing?
Well, unless you want to talk about Bloomberg ads, which are meaningless now, so those are the only ones I've seen.
Oh, no, I mean, I think in terms of enthusiasm, I think, again, part of it will depend on whether or not voters here feel like they're pivotal and they're enthusiastic. But I do think, so that we don't have a lot of ground game here, right? The Bloomberg ads are about to go away. I imagine some of those will be filled in with Biden ads, and we'll see that. And Sanders ads also, but I think my guess is Bloomberg is going to pay for the Biden ads.
That's a little bit, we're going off track a little here, but yeah, sure. The Bloomberg thing is important because he has, and I think he's serious, committed to basically putting his massive resources behind whoever the candidate is, particularly if it's Biden. So I think even before the primary is over, he'll do that. Frankly, I think even if it's Sanders in the general, he would probably end up putting his sort of machinery behind that. And I think that probably will help, but, you know, whoever the Democratic nominee is. So that's not to be underestimated. Obviously, Bloomberg wasn't able to sort of buy the nomination, but he was certainly, you know, he certainly has a lot of resources that will be helpful.
What issues do you think are important to New Yorkers, or what issues should they be watching for?
Sure. I mean, first of all, there's nothing to stop New York voters from paying attention to the many debates that will happen prior to the actual voting, although we do have a lot of evidence that people don't usually make up their mind until right beforehand. But I think healthcare is one of the big ones that on the Democratic side, there are different visions about how to increase access to healthcare and to lower costs. And I think those are some of the really big issues that the Democrats And again, if it's going to be a two-person race, if it's going to be Sanders versus Biden, I think paying attention to their different visions about the role that government can play in the healthcare sector will be really important.
A question about demographics. You know, we hear a lot about, you know, the Latino vote in regards to Bernie Sanders and, you know, if Joe Biden can capture some of that. And then, you know, the African-American vote with Joe Biden and, you know, if Bernie Sanders can capture some of that. How key is capturing demographics in this particular race? I mean, we hear a lot about it. Are there any chances folks might change their minds along the way here as we continue through the process, you know, of some of these battleground states that now that the field is narrowing somewhat?
Well, I think that it's entirely possible that people will change their minds. I mean, that was made clear, you know, last night, frankly. but even if we look back a little more historically, particularly if you're talking about black voters who were largely skeptical of Barack Obama in 2008 until he won Iowa and then sort of won some other states later on in the process and proved that he could win. So in that respect, you know, a lot of these demographic groups will, you know, are the same as anyone else in the sense that they're concerned about winning, you know. And so if a candidate can prove they can win, then they, you know, they'll have the support of most demographics, really. So in that sense, that's not to say that there aren't, you know, that African-American voters don't tend to prefer, you know, but haven't sort of tended to prefer Biden, and that a lot of Latino voters have tended to prefer Sanders. But nothing wins like winning, right? And so I think that's something to keep in mind, is that these groups are fluid if there are, you know, significant changes in the race.
Yeah. So I think it's worth, you know, keeping in mind that the Democratic Party is a coalition of different groups, identity
right.
groups. And so the winning coalition in November is about putting together the coalition of different groups within the Democratic Party. And so while we are seeing that Biden is performing very well with African-American voters across all states, and that started very strongly in South Carolina, and Bernie Sanders seemed in Nevada and California to do better than Biden among Latinos. There's also another dynamic here, which is that Sanders seems to be doing better among male Democrats than female Democrats, and there's no gender gap with Biden's vote, right? And so you want to think about, as candidates, how you put together a winning coalition, not just in the primary, but also in November. And so, again, I think many voters are very pragmatic, and they want to think about who not only benefits and is closest to their own preferences and has policies that they like, but also who can win in November. And so I do think you'll see some shifts, you know, as we go further along, and it seems who is viable and who isn't, right? That people vote for, again, they want this balance of, like, who is going to win and who is closest to my preferences. And sometimes one of those weighs more heavily than the other.
Any other observations or takeaways that either of you have before we wrap things up?
I mean, I would just echo what Jonathan said about money. I think one of the takeaways here is that for all of Bloomberg's cash and spending, right, that got him access to a lot of airwaves and to people's eyes, and it got him on the debate stage, but in and of itself did not get very many votes. He's coming away with some delegates, and he will use those resources to help the party. But it doesn't mean that money doesn't matter, but it is not sufficient in and of itself.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing I would sort of add, actually not related to money at all, though, is in terms of, you know, what to look for going forward is the possibility of a brokered convention. I know people have different views about 538, but, you know, as of right now, I think they have it at about a 1 in 3 chance, or it might even be 2 in 5 chance of a brokered convention, which is, you know, hasn't happened, obviously, since, I think, 1968. And so that's something to keep an eye on. And that's, you know, there's going to be a lot of interesting maneuvering that's going to go on around that. And then the question becomes, you know, how much effort do the Democrats put into avoiding that, because I don't think anybody really wants that. But then they're, you know, that's tempered by the fact that a lot of, you know, establishment Democrats also really don't want Sanders to be the nominee. So I think that's going to be something to keep an eye on is whether the Democrats end up deciding that, yes, a plurality is going to be enough to get the nomination, or if they're really going to take this to a floor fight and, you know, it goes to multiple ballots, which is certainly plausible at this point.
Right. Yeah. So the rules right now say that you have to have a majority to become the nominee. And if But that's only in the first round. In the second round, the superdelegates have an ability to vote for whoever they want. They're unbound by the what the voters say, and that is very distasteful to many people. But it is part of the party infrastructure in deciding which is this nominee who's going to be strongest in November.
Well, that wraps up WAER's 2020 Focus on Elections, Super Tuesday edition. Shayna Guderian and Jonathan Parent, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Shayna Guderian is Associate Professor of Political Science at Syracuse University's Maxwell School, and Jonathan Parent is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Lemoyne College. I'm Scott Willis. Stay with WAER News on the air and online for continuing coverage of the upcoming presidential and congressional primaries all the way through the general election.